Travel warning. This is a true story. There's a college in the United States that offers a course called Environmental Studies, or Environmental Science. Lots of universities and colleges have that. And it's just a fancy way of saying that it's a class about the outdoors. The class is very popular at this college because it includes several field trips, one of which is a very long hike into the mountains, up several steep trails. One year, to prepare the students for the hike, the professor gathered all the students in a clearing at the college and asked them to do something very unusual. "I want you to mingle around and grab each other's butts," he said. "Just keep grabbing each other's butts until I tell you to stop." So while 20 college students started moving among each other, grabbing each other's butts, they were a little nervous about it at first, but after a while it became fun. And they all had some good laughs, wondering what in the world the professor was doing, giving them such an odd thing to do. After the exercise, the professor told his class the reason for the unusual procedure. "We are going to be walking up a steep and narrow, slippery slope," he said. "Because of this, we'll have to walk in single file, hunched over using our hands and feet. If the person in front of you slips, the first thing you'll meet is his or her butt. If that happens, you need to reach up with both hands and grab on to stop him or her from falling. If you aren't used to touching someone's butt, you might be tempted to just step aside and let the person fall. This would put him or her at risk, as well as all of those behind you." Now, how would you feel if you were part of that class, taking part in this rather odd exercise? Would you be outraged? Embarrassed, probably. Uncomfortable, absolutely. To have someone, maybe even a stranger, grab your backside would get most of us running out of the room. But how do you feel about this exercise, all this grabbing, if you like, knowing the reason why the professor had the students undertake such an unusual exercise? You might say, "Well, okay, if it will save my life or someone else's, you can touch my butt." Not very sanitary, perhaps, but necessary. I just have to get beyond what I call the yuck factor. That is, doing the necessary thing, even if it makes me uncomfortable, or even makes my skin crawl, because the result will be positive, won't it? It could be even life-preserving. You and I, we overcome the yuck factor all the time in regards to children. We clean up after them. We wipe their drippy noses. We eat drippy ice cream cones. Oh, it happens in the medical field, doesn't it? Some medical tests and procedures are hardly comfortable, and they can be invasive and make us squeamish. But they can save our lives. Take dentistry as an example. No one lets other people, strangers, just come along at random and put their hands in their mouths. It's very unsanitary, isn't it? But we let our dentist and hygienist do it. Why do we do that? Because of the health benefit, right? Now here's an interesting question. How far are you willing to go to achieve that benefit? How much yuck can you tolerate? When does your self-preservation mechanism kick in and hold you back? Is it when something, or dare I say someone, is dirty, or perhaps germ-laden, covered with sores or smells, or is different from us in some very striking way? I don't know how many of you have seen the marvelous TV shows now, just on CDs and reruns, etc. It was simply called Monk. I don't know if you've seen that. It's also got a subtitle, The Defective Detective. It's a show where Adrian Monk is a private investigator, Hanazi, who is incredibly observant. Really gets all the details. But he also suffers from a bad case of obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. Everything, in his opinion, is dirty or germly. It makes life very hard for him. It makes everyone else around him compensate for his odd behavior. One such compulsive behavior he undertakes is that every time he shakes someone's hand, he immediately snaps his fingers, which is a mechanism for requesting from his assistant a disinfectant wipe to rid himself of possible germs. You can imagine how some people react when, after shaking Monk's hand, he immediately goes and gets a sanitary wipe and wipes his hand. Now, I'm not trying to make light of a very serious psychological problem, but I can't help but wonder if we all suffer at least a little bit from OCD. We're all somewhat obsessive in wanting everything to go a certain way, and to be insulated from anything that might make us uncomfortable or somehow, in our minds, contaminate us. You know, it isn't that many years ago where you couldn't find a hand sanitizer anywhere in a building. They're everywhere now, aren't they? In some ways, what the Good Samaritan story challenges is our obsessive compulsive nature. In interacting with the world, and more importantly, the people of this world, we want to know where we can draw the line. How can we remain isolated from those who are on the fringes? Is there anyone or a group of persons that's all right to just cross over to the other side of the street and make your way on? We wonder to ourselves, who can we ignore? Who can we avoid and still fulfill the command to love our neighbor as ourselves? How can I stay clear of the yucky bits of life and yet still be right in God's eyes? It's a good question. And frankly, we all have asked it at some point, whether we're aware of it or not. The lawyer who asked the question, who is my neighbor, may have wanted to justify himself, but he's asking the question we all want to know the answer to. Can I cross the street or ignore someone if they make me want to grab for a sanitary wipe? Jesus could have bluntly said to those who were listening to him that they know you can't ignore them. Instead, he tells the story. The details are very familiar to a lot of us. And wow, the challenge of this story is incredibly powerful. A Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho. It's a journey of about 18 miles, and he was going on foot. On his way to Jericho, he is attacked, he's beaten, he's robbed, he's stripped of his clothes, and he's left half dead. With his clothes taken and his body battered, and likely barely conscious, he could have been mistaken at a distance for being dead. That's an important detail to remember. At a distance, he would have looked dead. And the story continues, and a priest was making his way from Jerusalem, where he had probably just fulfilled his duties in the temple, and he comes across this beaten man at the side of the road. He sees this man in terrible straits, and immediately he crosses to the other side of the road and he carries on. The reasoning here is that the priest wanted to avoid touching a dead body or touching any blood at all because it would make them ritually unclean. He's a priest after all. Right? Soon another man comes along and he's referred to as a Levite or a temple assistant. He too wishes not to be contaminated, so he too crosses the other side of Mark's lawn. Neither man stops to see if the hurt man is even alive. Their ritual cleanliness was more valuable to them than the mercy for the wrong man. It's ironic that according to the Jewish law, in the book of Leviticus, it was priests and Levites who were entrusted with purifying physically afflicted people. It is the reason Jesus tells the leper after he's healed to go and show himself to a priest. Only a priest or a Levite could help someone become ritually clean, and both shirked their duty on that road. They could not get over the yuck factor. Third man comes along the road. This time the man is a Samaritan. Samaritans, as many of you know, were hated by the Jews. They were considered heretics. To be associated with a Samaritan and being Jewish was absolutely unheard of. So much so that the lawyer won't even use the word Samaritan when he says instead, the one who showed mercy. What we forget sometimes is that the Samaritans had the same rules in regards to cleanliness that Jews had. But he set them all aside. Carefully. Remember also that the injured man is Jewish. But the Samaritan didn't care about his ethnicity. Now, I should point out to you that the crowd who was listening to this story would have been outraged. They would have grumbled. They would have been scandalized by the plot of this particular story. But the real scandal in this story is that the priest and the Levite refused to help. In Hosea 6:6, we read God saying to Israel, I am interested in merciful kindness, not sacrifice. The contrast between the Samaritan and the two Jewish religious leaders is powerful. Remember that this story was prompted by a discussion about receiving eternal life. The lawyer answered correctly that you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and with all your mind. You must love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus replied, right, do this and you will live. Jesus' point here is you can't just fulfill half of that equation. You know, the priest and the Levite love God, I guess, in their own way. As their position and devotion seems to attest. But in loving their neighbor, they were found lacking. In the story, both the injured man and the Samaritan were neighbors. And whether someone is a neighbor is not defined by geography or ethnicity. True neighborliness comes out of love. Actually, there is not really a true definition of a neighbor because love never defines the object. All persons are neighbors because we are called to love all. This is the all-encompassing nature of love that should set Christians apart from the rest of the world. Such is the conclusion of David Neff, who is the editor of Christianity Today, who in 2008 attended a dialogue between Christians and Muslims entitled Loving God and Neighbor Together. This is what Neff wrote about his observation of this conference, or this gathering. The Christian participants have been taught by Jesus that love is to be indiscriminate, just as the mercy shown by the Good Samaritan was conditioned on nothing other than the wounded man's needs. That may not be the way we generally behave, but it's the way we have learned to think of ourselves. It is the standard on which we measure ourselves. Muslim participants startled us Christians by talking about the limits their religion brought to their compassion. Orphans, widows, and others in need through no fault of their own deserve compassion, they said. But in Islamic circles, there was no obligation to help a person whose drunkenness or gambling or otherwise unwise behavior put them in difficulty. Reflecting on what I heard, Neff says, those Muslim leaders say the tension was not between a generous God and a stingy God, but between mercy that was defined and controlled by justice, which is the Muslim view, and justice that is controlled and defined by mercy, which is the Christian view. What Neff is concluding is that it seems that our Muslim friends want to draw a line in the sand, limiting their compassion. I don't think it's just a Muslim phenomenon. I really don't. We all, on some level, want to grow living certainly. We want mercy to be expended only to those who meet somehow our defined criteria. Often our own criteria or some twisted effort at religious piety. If you want to gain eternal life, then there are to be no limits to your mercy. Your love or your compassion. None. Love of God and loving our neighbor as ourselves means getting your hands dirty occasionally. It means meeting the miserable, smelly, germ-laden, the yuckiness of life. It means going and doing what obsessive compulsive inclinations would try and get us to avoid. It means letting go of our prejudices, our past hurts, our own self-righteousness, to go where others would rather not go. It means following the example of a modern-day Good Samaritan that Gary Burke, professor of New Testament at Western University, writes in his book, Jesus, the Middle Eastern Storyteller. This is the account he has there. Not long ago, in Jerusalem's famed Hadassah Hospital, an Israeli soldier lay dying. He had contracted AIDS as a result of his gay lifestyle, and now was in the last stages of the disease's terrible course. His father was a famous Jerusalem rabbi, and both he and the rest of the family had disowned him. He was condemned to die in shame. The nursing staff on his floor knew his story, and they carefully avoided his room. Everyone was simply waiting for this man to die. The soldier happened to be part of a regiment that patrolled the occupied West Bank, and his red unit was known for its ferocity and its war-fighting skills. The Palestinians living in occupation hated these troops. They were merciless and could be cruel. Their distinctive green berets always gave them away. One evening, the soldier who was so ill in hospital went into cardiac arrest. All the usual alarms went off, and the nursing staff, they did not respond. Even the doctors on that floor that day looked the other way. Yet on that floor was another man. He was working as a janitor. He was a Palestinian Christian man who knew the soldier's story as well as anybody else and knew the meaning of the emergency signals. Incredibly, he was a man whose village had been attacked by this soldier's unit. When the Palestinian man heard the alarm and witnessed the neglect, his heart filled with compassion. He dropped his broom, entered the soldier's room, and attempted to resuscitate the man, giving him CPR. The scene was remarkable. A poor Palestinian man, a victim of that soldier's violence, now tried to save his enemy, while those who should have been doing this stood on the side. It's an incredible story, one which captures what Jesus is trying to say to us. I guess there's really only one thing left for me to tell you. Now go do like